Today on Golazzo, we journey back to the early 80s and the story of a Roma side who touched the sky and paid the price, and probably the referee too. The side that put the giallo in giallorossi in this Golazzo.
Lasciatemi cantare con la chitarra in mano. Lasciatemi cantare una canzone piano piano.
It's the summer of 1982. James Horncastle is just back from the nursery, right?
No, I'm still a tadpole.
Are you not even in 1982?
No.
Christ on a bike.
Yeah, sorry.
Gab, you're still in Frankfurt, are you?
I am, yes.
All right, lovely. The Italian national side are back from the World Cup, as we mentioned on a recent Golazzo, so they are world champions, and they're about to
They all play for Juventus.
And they all play for Juventus. Serie A, for all Juve's might which had been increased over the summer by the additions of...
Zibi Boniek and Michel Platini.
Right. Serie A was about to see some unlikely winners of their own, a Roma side. It's interesting when you look back at that season following the World Cup and the boom, the enthusiasm around calcio, the lineup on the starting grid for Serie A, you have Trapattoni's Juve, who've basically won every single title going for the last 5 years. You've got Inter, who are massive, and then even the newly promoted sides, Pisa not so much, but Verona, who within a season or two are going to become title contenders, and the Sampdoria, who get promoted that season, 82-83, and what a side they'd put together.
Yeah, I mean, they signed Trevor Francis,
yep.
Liam Brady, who had to make way for Platini at Juventus.
Right.
They've got Bobby Mancini.
18-year-old Roberto Mancini.
The incredible thing, James, is that everyone looks at Juventus, and on paper they're the strongest team that has ever been, you know, particularly in the warm glow of winning the World Cup.
They'd also won the Serie A title the two previous years as well.
Mm. And this Samp side that comes up beats them on the opening day of the season.
This Samp side beats them. The following week, they beat Inter with a brace from Trevor Francis. And then who do they beat in the third week?
Roma.
Yeah, incredible start by Sampdoria. But it's Roma we're here to talk about. And that Roma team, now, only a few years before, they'd been taken over by Dino Viola. And his impact had been pretty immediate in terms of making them, a struggling club, into real contenders.
And this is the thing, James, because 2 years before the title win, Roma are contending for the Scudetto with Juventus. And what, third game before the end of the season, Juventus and Roma play in Turin. It's a top of the table clash. There's a point between them. If Roma win it, they leapfrog them. They maybe win the league for the first time since 42. It's 0-0. And what happens towards the end? Bruno Conti puts in a cross. There's Ramon Turone, gets on the end of it. It looks like a legit goal, but the whistle blows. And who's blowing the whistle? Paolo Bergamo, who I think, did we talk about in the Calciopoli scandal? Anyway, we'll flash forward to that again at a later date.
We'll talk
Bergamo,
about him in
one
this...
of the two heads of referees in the Calciopoli scandal.
A man whose name is also linked to the Dundee United affair. But we'll come on to that later on. Yes, the Turone goal, which to this day is still one of the most talked about incidents in Roma's long battle with the clubs up north, the wins from the north.
Giampiero Boniperti, the president of Juventus, obviously hears, listens to all the noise that Roma make about this, particularly Dino Viola afterwards. And Viola, a few days later, receives a package from Turin. It's from Boniperti, and inside there is a ruler with which he can measure the offside because he's been banging on about it.
Savage. So Roma have already managed to establish themselves as credible rivals to Juve. They've also picked up trophies pretty much every season, not the Scudetto, but Coppa Italia's and the like. And by 82-83, Dino Viola has managed to, while battling Juve, put together one of the great giallorossi sides, starting with the manager.
Yeah, Niels Liedholm, who is one of those sort of fascinating characters you get popping up in Italy, you know, and not just in Italy, but elsewhere, you know, those guys who move to a country as players, and then they just kind of never leave. And they sort of half maintain their own culture and background and then half adopt that of their adopted country. Now, Niels Liedholm had come to Italy, I believe, in the early 50s or late 40s and played for this incredible Milan side who won the title twice.
Grenoli, no?
The Grenoli side, which comes from, it was Gunnar Gren, Gunnar Nordahl, who is the second highest goal scorer in the history of Serie A, and, you know, after Zlatan, of course, the greatest ever Swedish player, and Nils Lidholm, who was sort of the creative mind in the midfield. And
he never misplaced a pass until one time, and when he did, San Siro hadn't seen it happen in so long that legend has it that they all stood up and applauded.
And he was sort of, by the standards of time football back then, he was sort of very calm, very laid back, always kind of spoke slowly and carefully. And it was exactly what Roma needed, because they found him to be sort of this odd foreign guy. And, you know, by this stage, he would have been in his 60s, I would assume.
The Baron, they called him.
Yeah.
The weird thing about him as well was that he'd been part of that great Milan lineup. And as a manager in this period, he was kind of commuting between Rome and Milan, doing one season with the Giallorossi and then back with the Rossoneri and then back to the Giallorossi again.
Yeah, I mean, he was famous for kind of launching young players as well. I think at Milan, he was the guy who gave Franco Baresi his debut. He was in charge of Milan when they won the Scudetto della Stella. And that was a big vindication for him, because at that point, people just thought of him as this guy who would come in. He was good at kind of low to mid-ranking clubs and good for launching young players, but never won anything. Also because Lidholm played a style of football that was, I'd say, unusual in Italy, that he was a big advocate for zonal marking, passing football, and that sort of thing. And in terms of temperament and style of management, Gab will probably know more about this than I do, because he spent more time with him. But Carlo Ancelotti, who would obviously play under Lidholm, has a lot of Lidholm's character traits in terms of how man manages certain situations. I think there's a lot of... I remember the first big interview I did as a journalist when I came back to England was to do Ancelotti at Chelsea. And I remember he took particular enjoyment out of talking about Nils Lidholm.
It is funny that sort of the two big influences on Ancelotti's career as a manager are the two polar opposites, Nils Lidholm and Eddie Gosacki. In terms of man management style, because, you know, I sort of lay back, I'm everybody's friend, I want to make sure everybody likes me, I'll always kind of, you know, stay calm, and players really respond to that. And, you know, you were talking about this great team that they put together. Ancelotti, he'd come up at Parma, he'd moved to Roma, and he had sort of next superstar painted all over him. And he would have been part of the Italy team that won the 82 World Cup, no question about it, if not for his bad knees. He returned, I think, in October.
Yeah, he misses the first seven games or something.
And immediately that has an effect on a team. But to give an idea, when you ask Ancelotti about it, he also minimizes. It's like, yeah, I think I undoubtedly had an effect. But the fact that I was playing with Paolo Roberto Falcao also made things
midfield
a lot easier.
So let's just have a... Sorry, James.
Well, there's a story which kind of links all this together, which is... Ancelotti's knee blowouts happen in games where Roma, La Magica, score two of the best goals I think you will ever see. So there's one the season before they win the league title. They're playing Fiorentina at the Olimpico. And this ball comes in and you see Paolo Roberto Falcao backheel volley for Roberto Pruzzo to head in. And then the year when they are champions and they're defending their title, they play against Juve at the Comunale, and you see the ball never hits the floor, and the final touch is Pruzzo's bicycle kick, and he dedicates the goal to Ancelotti, whose knee had blown out again in that game. And yeah, both of those goals, I would say, would encapsulate some of the skill, some of the ability in this Roma side.
Falcao's arrival, meanwhile, had seen one of the great Italian playmakers move back into a kind of more of a defensive role, Agostino Di Bartolomei, who has perhaps the biggest role of anyone in this team.
I would say the most influential captain, arguably of all time. I mean, Totti has his own claim to that, but Di Bartolomei, again, every Roma side that won the league title had a captain or a leading figure in it from the city. And
can you tell us who the one from the 1942 team was?
Amadei. There you go. But you talk about Lidholm basically taking this guy who was a sort of deep-lying midfield playmaker, had a great range of passing, had this sassata, you know, this sort of really, talk about powerful shots. We talked about Adriano last week. Di Bartolomei was one of his key attributes as well. But He goes and plays at the back. And again, it's all about this kind of passing football that Lidom wants to start. And Lidom surrounds him with, he says he's got the quickest defense in Italy, because you need one when you've got Di Bartolomeo back there.
Really, really ponderously slow.
But he signs the Tsar, Pietro Virkiwad. Virkiwad, I think, along with Mancini and someone else, one of like a handful of players to have won the league with two clubs that are not Juventus, Inter or Milan. He would win it with Juventus later on, Virkiwad, but that's by the way. Maldera as well, and Sabino Nella.
Yep.
Super quick. Fullbacks.
Also, and you've got the keeper, Tancredi, but not that Tancredi. All these great names playing in that splendid floppy-collared Barilla shirt. And, of course, legendary names there. Conte, we briefly touched on, who'd had that incredible World Cup. But the man whose image is really forever stamped on this side, not just this season, but also the subsequent one, and then for events that come later, is Agostino Di Bartolomeo. The season begins with the two promoted sides flying out the blocks. We talked about Sampdoria. Verona were as well. What do you remember of that campionato?
Well, in addition, as you say, when we first started seeing like how good Verona could be and Sampdoria with the youngsters, and also the fact that Turone, who you mentioned, who had been sort of the symbol of Roma getting screwed out of titles in the mind of Roma fans, he was sold in, back then you had an extra transfer window, I think in October. And in some ways, getting rid of him was kind of like getting rid of a bunch of people in football are very superstitious of exercising your bad luck charm. But the other interesting thing, and just which I thought just sort of serves as a reminder of, you know, how kind of the Overton window has shifted, and we sort of take it for granted that teams go and win titles with 80, 90 points, you know, not just in Italy. Was remarkable about that. Roma won the title that season, and I'd forgotten this. I'm looking at this now. It was a 30-game season, and if it had been 3 points for a win, as it is now, and admittedly it is a shorter season, they would have had 59 points from 30 games if it had been 3 points. So that's less than 2 points a game. Today you have teams that get 2 points a game that finish sixth, and it's pretty routine. To me, that's absolutely incredible how we've lost that. We're so used to now sort of dominating teams going out there and blowing everybody away. And to me, that's kind of food for thought. The other interesting thing is that season, Roma, they won 13 of 15 games at home. Away from home, they won 3 of 15 games.
Really?
They drew 2/3 of their games away from home. But that was the idea. It's like, win your home games, draw away from home, and you'll be fine. And that's completely, completely gone out the window in today's football.
Also, you talk about home advantage, let's say. In this season, you've got to talk about the Comandos Ultras Curva Sud now. The Cooks, who the choreographies that they put on, the atmosphere that they created. I think it was maybe the year after where they did that massive Ti Amo, I love you kind of choreography. Just amazing to see the Olympico. Particularly, there was a game towards the end of the season where they play against Juve. Falcao puts them in front after 7 minutes. They start celebrating. They think they're going to win the title. And then in the final 5 minutes, Juventus score twice. I think Platini scores an incredible free kick. And all of a sudden, you know, the doubt kind of creeps in. They have to go to Pisa the next week where they win. And at that point, they're like, yeah, okay, mentally we're strong enough to do this. We can go and do it. But if you watch any of the footage from that era and see the Stadio Olimpico, it is...
With no roof.
With no roof, sense. And it is just a sea of orange and yellow. It's...
That Pisa game, it was a 3-1 victory, and a lot of, I think, Roma, kind of historic Roma fans will point to that as the day when they felt, we've got this, and Falcao scores a famous goal and then rolls one sleeve up as if to say, come on, lads, up and at him. Kind of Mazzola style, if you like. Di Bartolomeo scored that day as well. And as May rolls round, Roma mathematically sealed the title on the 8th of May with a 1-1 draw away at Genoa. But the funny thing is that the title's almost already won for them before that, because there was a match on the 1st of May between Juve and Inter, in the build-up to which a Juve fan threw a brick through the window of the Inter bus, which injured one of their players, Giampiero Marini. And the game was subsequently awarded 2-0 to Inter, Juve being Roma's main rivals. That pretty much effectively handed them the title. So in terms of, you know, late drama and winning the Scudetto, it didn't quite happen.
The scenes in Genoa are extraordinary, because essentially the yellow and red side of Rome, which is most of Rome, let's not beat around the bush there, just leaves the city, follows the team to Genoa. And you can see the final kind of 5 minutes. All of the fans are on the sidelines, ready to invade the pitch. And the kind of flash interviewer, Galeazzi, is trying to get the lead home and can't get to him. And he's getting really frustrated and impatient with these fans who are just kind of putting scarves around Lidom's neck and tying a flag as though it's a cape. And Lidom just kind of bats him off as he's like insulting these fans. And Lidom's like, it's for them. It's for them. It's just amazing.
Galeazzi, recurrent problem in those years and the ones to come. Wild celebrations in the capital, the first title since 41-42. And then that's followed by the... Now, this is really bizarre. Can you explain why, following the title win, they were then playing in the Coppa Italia quarterfinals in June against Juventus? How are they having the Coppa Italia quarterfinals in June?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the... when they, for example, reached the European Cup final the following year, which we'll get to... again, have to play, I think, two rounds of the Coppa Italia after that. Coppa Italia goes way into June. I imagine in this circumstance, it's maybe because the season starts late after the World Cup or something like that, but it happens again the following year, so...
Yeah, I mean, Coppa Italia in June is one thing, but the quarterfinals still? Mm. Anyway, Roma Campioni then, and the following season was even more dramatic. In the league, they finished second, but the story of the campaign was all about Europe, really, the European Cup, the final of which was going to be in Roma's own stadium, the Olimpico. And they managed to get there, but the campaign is in many ways anything but glorious.
It really was a different era back then because you didn't have the coverage we have today. Foreign teams felt really, really foreign. And so there's two competing narratives here. There's the Roman narrative where, you know, we managed to get there, reach the final in our own stadium.
They'd never played the European Cup before. That's another thing that I think, as Gab kind of alluded to.
They don't won the league once before.
Yeah, it's not like Champions League where four teams get in it.
Yeah.
This was, and they felt it was their destiny because it's like the 1 year we're in it and the final's in Rome.
And they get there, and what had happened, and you know, I think there's Liverpool fans have written books about this. What often kind of got ignored was back then it was kind of like everything went, and there were attacks on Liverpool fans sort of throughout the day before and afterwards. The city just completely lost its collective mind. You know, and this is a city too where I think even to this day, a lot of the cops are either, depending on their political stripe, they're either Lazio fans or a lot of Roma fans among them. And they just completely lost it. And it was a pretty horrible, horrible night, which some people have later said, you know, tied it in to, because of course other people can't distinguish between one team and another team, tied it into events that would lead to Heysel a year later.
Il grande mercoledì è dunque arrivato. Si disputa la finalissima di Coppa dei Campioni tra la Roma e il Liverpool.
They'd not conceded, I think, a single goal at home in their entire European campaign to this point. But about 5 minutes in, Phil Neal scores for Liverpool after a bizarre mix-up, which sees the ball bounce off Tancredi's head.
Which again, Roma fans think, you know, should never have stood.
Whelan's up on the far side, and Rush almost got in there, but it might come for Phil Neal. And it's given. Liverpool are in the lead.
Is it Ronnie Whelan?
Yeah.
He, like, sort of charges Tancredi. The ball falls. Tancredi's got, like, Whelan studs imprinted in his thigh. And there was a lot of speculation in the 3 weeks before the game that the referee was Swedish, like Lidholm.
Mm.
And they felt that the referee was trying to kind of overcompensate. It's like, I'm not going to give them any kind of favours. And yeah, Neal scores. Pruzzo equalises. In the second half, there's a couple of chances that Roma don't take. And it goes to penalties, James.
And it goes to penalties,
Gav. Still leans their way because Steve Nichol, my ESPN colleague, lines up to take the penalty kick and he misses.
And Steve Nichol make it 1-0 for Liverpool. Five penalties for each side, remember? Oh, bad news.
Up next for Roma is Di Bartolomé, who puts his away.
Obviously. And then, unfortunately, the ones who missed for Roma
Conti, Graziani.
Errore. 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 E il Liverpool conquista la sua quarta Coppa dei Campioni.
Where was Falcao?
Well, that's the... This became one of the stories of that. Among all the recriminations afterwards, the idea that Falcao had refused to take a penalty. There were stories even that the captain, Di Bartolomei, and Falcao had come to blows in the dressing room afterwards, but people point out that Falcao wasn't a penalty taker for Roma.
And also Di Bartolomei, as we would tragically find out, was also somebody who, I mean, before everything that happened later, you know, he's also somebody who famously brought a gun onto the team bus and thought it was funny. So the remarkable thing about that, for all the recriminations, you know, Roma's four penalty takers, Di Bartolomeo and Ubaldo Righetti, the center back, both scored. The ones who missed it were Bruno Conti, arguably Roma's most talented player, and Ciccio Graziani, perhaps less talented, but, you know, still a center forward.
Right.
So, you know, it's not like one of those weirdo situations where, you know, you've got Tancredi taking penalties.
Yeah, but by that point, they had to deal with Grobbelaar's wobbly knees, which I don't think he did for the first two kicks.
No, the spaghetti legs.
The spaghetti legs.
But, yeah, Falcao's a no-show, and he kind of claims that he'd had a knee injury, I think, against Inter, and he'd been playing with sort of pain-killing injections, and after 120 minutes, they'd walk off, and he couldn't take it anymore. He felt like he couldn't walk, certainly felt like he couldn't kick with the kind of power that he felt he needed. But, yeah, a lot of his teammates, Graziani included, said, like, you know, part of being a champion is that you take responsibility, and in that moment he wasn't there.
Falcao, who'd become the eighth king of Rome in popular parlance for his success with the Giallorossi,
abdicates.
Yeah, abdicates. And a lot of people, I think, felt that kind of marked the end of his reign as the ruler of that club. And many things were to change. You had Sven-Göran Eriksson, whose Benfica side had put Roma out of the European Cup the previous season, and who was watching in the stands that day at the Olimpico, ready to take over from the Baron Nils Liedholm.
Yeah, and to go back what I said before about how different football was back then, one of the most interesting things I read before Roma played Liverpool in the semi-final last year was Peter Moore, who's the Liverpool chairman or chief executive or whatever. He tweeted out the match report compiled by Liverpool scout ahead of that final. It looks like it's written on like a dot matrix printer or something. This guy back then, he'd written a report based on two Roma games. He'd made a trip to Italy. And it's funny because he's like, you know, oh, like Dario Bonetti, who fans in Scotland might remember. Oh, he's clearly their strongest player. And like his reading of what Roma were like, based on the two games that he saw, was just all over the place. You know, to the point that whatever information he gleaned, even the stuff with the penalty kicks too, he ends up saying like, it's probably best if Bruce stands still and, you know, doesn't move at all until the very last. Well, what he would base that on, because he didn't see Roma taking penalties, nobody knows. But it's just a reminder that, you know, here's the guy who's a chief scout, you know, trusted advisor to, was it Joe Fagan who was the manager at the time?
Yeah. Or,
comes back with this basically useless nonsense. And you can't blame him because there was no Y Scout, there's no YouTube, there's no, you know, you barely had televisions back then. And it's just funny when we talk about how people prepare for games back then and these great managers.
Do you think he actually went to Italy, or did he just sit at home and write some expense forms? Oh,
yeah. I mean, this is the other thing that...
To Manchester Airport.
Liverpool had gone to Tel Aviv to prepare for this.
That's right, yeah.
I think there's some quite famous stories about that. But you look at that Liverpool side, they won... In the last 12 years, they won 8 league titles, 4 league cups. They'd won the European Cup 3 times, UEFA Cup twice, the FA Cup once, the European Super Cup once.
I think they'd won like every game away from home leading up to the final, something stupid like that. I mean, they oozed so much confidence going in there that... They really probably didn't even need this guy scouting report. Campionato di
calcio italiano. You're listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show.
We should talk about the semi-final now.
Well, this marked the end of an era. I think another nail in the coffin of that side were the allegations that came out and were subsequently admitted to by the son of the owner, Riccardo Viola. So this is the semi-final then. They're taking on Dundee United, who beat them 2-0 in Scotland for the second leg at the Stadio Olimpico, and Roma, desperate to get through to this final of destiny in their own stadium, managed to come out 3-0 winners Pruzzo gets a brace, and then Di Bartolomei scores a penalty, the crucial penalty, as it turns out, and through they go. However, stories emerge about the referee, Michel Vautreau, who is sent to a restaurant ahead of this second leg of the semi-final, where he receives a phone call, which is code for the fact, these are the allegations that later emerges, as I say, that he was to be paid £50,000 for waving the Jalorossi through.
Should we tell our younger listeners that when we say he receives a phone call at the restaurant, it means that somebody telephoned the restaurant, something called a landline, because he didn't have his mobile phone with him at the time, and then he left the room because that's and went to answer said call. So the people who are at the table don't actually know what was said.
And he gets a call from this guy, Paolo. And for years to come, there'd be a lot of speculation about who this Paolo is. Brings a lot of scrutiny on a referee at the time, Paolo Casadin. And I think...
You think of another referee whose name is Paolo?
Paolo Bergamo.
Paolo Bergamo. Who?
Now he denies it.
Well, Ian Herbert of the Daily Mail wrote a story about this before last year's semi-final between Roma and Liverpool about this. And he says that Sports Mail understands that Landini, who was basically this go-between...
Spartaco Landini.
He admitted in a covertly recorded interview in 2012 that the so-called Vautreau bribe was a scam organised between him and another football executive designed to procure money from the unsuspecting Viola.
So they took the money from Viola, but then never gave it to the referee. And in fact, Roma would say in their defence that when you look at the game, even though, yes, they were given a penalty, which... put them through. It was actually a fair call. There was nothing untoward
also,
in that
James,
game.
They Roma had won 2-0. Two goals 3-0. Disallowed in that game.
Right, and their opening goal was
and
disallowed.
And Maldera was shown a yellow card and was suspended for the final.
Well,
so they feel that, you know, they took some hits.
Yes, we tried to bribe the ref, but it didn't work, so we're innocent. They were suspended from European football for a season by UEFA, but then that was later overturned in favour of a fine, and Dino Viola was banned from official UEFA activities for 4 years, which I'm sure must have stung. The thing is, I mean, there's been kind of stories one way or the other, but Ricardo Viola, his son, I think it was actually in 2018, wasn't it, that he...
It was on Mediaset.
That he gives
like
this interview where he says, yeah, we did that. Yeah, it's all true.
And then was like, no. What was I saying? No.
What I don't get about this, too, is... If Ian Herbert's story is correct with the covert interview, it's entirely possible that Ricardo Viola thought his dad was bribing the referee, but then it never actually happened. Or maybe even he says, well, I don't want to make my memory of my dad seem stupid, that he'd be ripped off by somebody named Spartaco. So, you know, I'll say that, yeah, we did do it. But do you know what I mean? Like,
the amazing thing is, is that the follow-up to this is that the tape interview was undertaken by an Italian referee, Paolo Bergamo, who wanted to prove that he was not the mysterious middleman Paolo. Landini basically admits on a covertly recorded wiretap
that
the bribe was a scam to get money from Viola.
The person who's talking to him is...
But apparently the person who recorded him saying that was Paolo Bergamo to basically prove that I'm not the Paolo who called... the restaurant, you know?
As if, yeah.
Paolo Bergamo would want to stay away from wiretaps at this stage,
juncture
of his career. But the one other thing, again...
Well, maybe he got really well sort of versed in them, Gav. I don't know, you know?
The other thing that I want to emphasize, and I go back to this about how different it was back then, because I thought this was just simply grotesque. So Dundee United had won the Scottish title the year before, and it was a really big deal because obviously everybody knows it's Celtic and Rangers, and back then Aberdeen were managed by some guy named Sir Alex Ferguson.
And they were not sure semi-finals of the UEFA Cup at the same time, I think.
Yeah, you had all these really big teams, and little Dundee United go and win it, and their manager was a guy named Jim McLean, who'd also been an assistant to Jock's team with the Scotland team. He made a joke sort of after the first leg about how we're all on steroids from the high of having been with a Scotland team or something like that, even used it as a metaphor, right? But he's obviously joking and he's speaking metaphorically. But of course, with, you know, the real high-end translations that you had back then, the story became reported in Italy, like, you know, Jim McLean admits that his team are all on performance-enhancing drugs.
Mm. No relation to John McLean.
Yeah, which... You know, or James McLean, who spells his name differently. Okay. So it created kind of this atmosphere of like, poor little Roma, how are they going to deal with all these sort of, you know, drug-addled Scots? right? And some people, because Viola remains a very popular figure in Rome, despite many things, say that, well, he had no choice but to receive assurances from the referee because they were all on drugs. And that was part of the absolutely ludicrous defense that came out.
Walter Smith was Jim McLean's assistant.
Huh.
And again, in the great in Herbert piece, he says, he kind of just holds his hand up and says, Roma were an excellent side. And the regret was that after going 2-0 up, we had a good chance of getting to the final, but didn't take it. We just didn't play as well as we normally did in Rome that night. Liverpool showed the greater experience to deal with the journey in a difficult environment. So,
30th of May 1984. And as I say, it was very much the end of an era for the Giallorossi. Falcao, Lidholm heads off to Milan. He takes Di Bartolomeo with him. It should all have been so different in the Roma vision.
Other side of the city, the night of the final,
right,
at Circo Massimo,
yeah,
Antonello Venditti is playing a concert, which is essentially supposed to be a kind of celebration for Roma winning,
right,
the
now
European
this is the
Cup.
Venditti who produced one of the great football anthems in commemoration of the Scudetto win the previous season, Grazie Roma. And was now ready to celebrate, no doubt, with another classic track. But it didn't happen. 10 years later, on the 30th of May, 1994, Di Bartolomei steps out onto his balcony on a sunny morning, puts his pistol against his heart and pulls the trigger. And it's been a lot said about how he ended up, the financial woes, his feeling of isolation from the game. But the fact that he chooses the 10-year anniversary of that defeat on penalties to Liverpool speaks volumes. Naturally, Antonello Venditti did a song commemorating Di Bartolomei.
You know, obviously, as I mentioned, this is a guy who'd had a lot of issues and just couldn't cope. You know, people talk about sort of the transition professional athletes make when they stop playing. And this is a guy who kind of lived it with such intensity. After he retired, he tried his hand at different things, and I think he really struggled. And some people said things didn't work out. His charisma didn't perhaps translate the way it did when he was a player. People have said that he also had some financial difficulties precisely because of this. I don't know. But, you know, it was obviously a very, very, very jarring end to it.
Right.
And people have also suggested that the 10-year anniversary was really just a coincidence.
Well, the fact that he chooses the day, 10 years on, the 30th of May 1994, to end it all, I think can hardly be just chance.
I think he felt marginalised and isolated, completely left adrift by the game, which, as Gab says, he lived so intensely. He, I think, was promised over and over again that he would have some role at Roma or another football club, be it a coaching role. Those promises were never fulfilled. He wanted to set up a football school down in Salerno because I think he ended his career at Salernitana. And, you know, getting that off the ground was really problematic. You know, lots of spanners thrown in the works in that. And there's a couple of really great things I think you should watch too if you want to know more about this. There's an actual documentary called Undici Metri, which is about Di Bartolomei. But there's also another Paolo Sorrentino film, L'Uomo in Più, which really explores that theme of as Gab was saying, someone who's transitioning from being not just a player, but a legend.
I mean, Sorrentino's brilliant. That title, L'Uomo in Più, is just such a brilliant turn of phrase because it means sort of the extra man. And you can read it in so many ways. You can obviously read it as the fact that, you know, he played as a sweeper, so he was the spare man. You can talk about how the extra lift he gave Roma, but it's also kind of like, you know, when, you know, you have something extra or additional in Pew that you don't need.
Surplus.
And he wasn't needed. Yeah, he was surplus to requirements.
Well, Roma in the early 80s, the best of times are very much the worst of times. We'll leave it there for this week's Golazzo with Antonello Venditti doing his...
Before we get to Sven.
Yeah, I think we'll save Sven for another day. And
it allowed me to revisit Sven's incredible biography again.
Right.
Talks about him playing tennis with Ricardo Viola. Ricardo saw himself as the better player than I was, but I always beat him.
There you go, Sven. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing more about Svenis and his tennis soon on Golazzo. But as we play out with Venditti and Tradimento e Perdono, dedicated to Di Bartolomei, and also another fallen Italian sporting hero, Marco Pantani, it's many thanks to James Horncastle and Gabriele Marcotti, and you, listener, and from all of us here, arrivederci.
Ricordati di me, mio capitano. Fanno nascere un uomo, ora rinasci tu, quel sorriso sgomento, anche se finto, non mi tormenta più.
You've been listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show. It's a Muddy Knees Media production, and for sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Check out our other football shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audioboom, and everywhere else you get your audio on demand.